Right, well, I think most people are back, so we will make a start. We're continuing our series, working our way through Luke's Gospel, called Following Jesus. And today we're looking at a specific event in Jesus' life. But I want to start by asking a question. Who would you have on your team? Imagine whether that's sport or work or whatever it is. When you have to gather a group of people, who would you have on your team? Now, it's always a bit sad for me at school, in that you wouldn't guess this now, maybe, to look at me, but I wasn't very sporty or very athletic. And you know how, do they still do it at schools? I don't think they should, because for insecure people it's horrendous. Picking the team. So all the class line up, and it's, you've got the two most popular sporty people captaining each side. And then the PE teacher would say, PE teacher got a lot to answer for. The PE teacher would say, right, pick a team. And of course they go, oh, I'll have him, I'll have him. And then it would always get down to just me and a lad called Nigel. It was always me and Nigel were the last two. And, you know, Nigel, I understand why they didn't pick him. But, you know, why not me? And it would always be us. And especially if it was rugby. It would always be me and Nigel left there. Because in those days, I hadn't bulked up like I have now. I didn't work out so much. And I was a little bit of a skinny lad. Not really cut out for rugby. I have to say, it didn't really bother me in our school. And I want to stress, in our school, I'm not insulting all rugby players here. Not trying to stereotype rugby players. But in our school, they were certainly a little further down the evolutionary tree. You know, very thick skulls, big muscle development, communicated largely in grunts and things like that. They really were not the sort of people I would normally hang out with. Can I just say, I was always picked for the school quiz team. So that was all right. Much more my sort of thing. But we tend to have these criteria, don't we? If we're picking people to be on our team, if maybe we can choose who we work with or whatever, we have in our mind certain criteria, who we would pick, the sort of people we would want to be around. Well, in this passage, Luke 6, verses 12 to 16, we see Jesus picking his disciples. Jesus chooses his 12 disciples. And we're going to think this morning about how he chooses them, and who he chooses, and what that says to us about the importance of discipleship. Luke 6, 12 to 16. One of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, and spent the night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. Simon, who he named Peter, his brother Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. So Jesus spends his time praying and chooses these 12 disciples. And we might wonder, well, why does he do it now? Why at this point in his ministry does he call these 12? Well, I think one of the clues for why he does it is actually in the previous verse, in verse 11. Where it says, but the Pharisees and teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. So what Jesus is beginning to realize is that his ministry is beginning to come towards its end. The beginning of the end, if you like, is there. The opposition is beginning to grow, and he knows that there will come a time when that opposition will result in his crucifixion. People are beginning to plot against him. They're beginning to realize that they're going to have to do something to get rid of Jesus, that he isn't going to go away, that his popularity is increasing, and that they're going to have to actually act to remove him. And so Jesus' aim is that his disciples will carry on his work. And that's why he, at this point, chooses the 12 disciples, whom he also calls apostles. The word apostle means someone who is sent. If you send someone to the shops for you, in one sense you could say that they're apostles. You've sent them to the shops. But in this sense, of course, it's a slightly bigger scale, slightly grander task that they have, that they are being equipped and sent to continue the work that Jesus is doing. So at this point, when he realizes that there's a turning point in his ministry, he chooses these 12. And first thing we see is that prayer is the key to his choice. It's very interesting how differently Jesus works to how we might work nowadays. Nowadays, we would probably get a sort of psychological profile of all the disciples and get them to do all sorts of different personality assessment tests. And then we try and make sure we had a team that could work together and all those sorts of things. And there is a place for it. I'm not saying that there's no place for that. But Jesus doesn't. Instead, he makes prayer his focus. And it was actually an extended time of prayer. It says Jesus prayed through the night. He prayed all night seeking his Father for wisdom as to which disciples to choose. He had a bigger group of followers and he was going to pick some out of that group. Who to choose? How would he know? It was through prayer that he was to find out. Now, as we thought a few weeks ago, the Bible is very clear that Jesus is God in human form. The Bible is very clear on that. But it's also very clear that while he was on earth in his earthly ministry, he didn't use his divine powers, sort of cheating, if you like, pretending to be human but using his divine powers. He didn't do that. He was dependent on his Father through prayer. And that's what we see him doing here. He was seeking the Father's will through prayer to know which disciples to choose. But it was an extended time of prayer. And that's because sometimes it takes longer for God to really speak to us. And I think one of the real challenges for us as we look at Jesus' example here is, when did we last set aside an extended time of prayer to really seek God, to really seek God's direction? You see, for most of us, I imagine, I'm certainly including myself here, that most of us, our prayer times tend to be perhaps a little bit hurried, we're a bit short of time, and we're quite proud of ourselves if we manage a prayer time before we go off to work. So, whoa, I am spiritual. I've actually managed a prayer time. And the idea of setting aside 4, 5, 6 hours to pray is quite alien to us. In fact, the thing most people ask me is, what on earth would you pray about for that long? And of course, that immediately reveals, and if you were thinking this, I mean you, that immediately reveals a flawed understanding of what prayer is. It reveals an understanding of prayer where we basically continually speak to God. I don't know if you can think of people you know who what I call speak anaerobically. They never seem to draw air. You know, normally a normal person breathes, and as they breathe, you can dive in to say, well, is that the time I've got to be going, and run for the door, or whatever. That's quite difficult if they speak anaerobically. We have a few visitors sometimes who do that, one or two we're related to who might listen to this, so I won't name them. They'll know who they are, though. And so sometimes I've had to resort to things like subtly on my mobile ringing the home phone so that the phone rings. So I say, oh, sorry, that's the phone. And go and answer it and speak to myself on the phone. Next time any of you are around our house and the phone rings, you're going to be wondering, aren't you, has he called himself? I've sometimes texted myself saying, you need to go. So I can then say, oh, I've got a text saying I need to go, which is an absolutely true statement. So, we all know those sort of people. They just talk at us and talk at us. And so often that is the approach we have to prayer. That we basically talk at God. Oh, and Lord, can you do this? And God, oh, and by the way, Lord, can you do this? Now, the advantage of an extended time of prayer is you can't keep that up for 6 or 7 hours. And an extended time of prayer forces us to be silent. It forces us to actually listen to God. It forces us to stop, keep rabbiting on, and to ask God what he wants to do in and through us. And I think there's a real danger in the Western church that we have got into the cultural mindset of everything being instant. Coffee is instant, communication is instant, this is instant, that's instant. Prayer cannot be instant. Not because God is incapable of communicating quickly. Of course, he could do that. Some sort of spiritual download straight into your brain so that, you know, you've got everything he needs you to know. But at the heart of prayer is relationship. And relationships can't be instant. However popular speed dating may be, that is not a real relationship. And we're not going to grow in our relationship with God if we just speed date him 5 minutes on our way to work. We need to set aside time when, like Jesus does here, particularly if we're facing bigger decisions, particularly if something crucial is coming up in our lives, it simply is not good enough to pray a 5 minute prayer, basically telling God what our plan is and asking him to bless it. And as someone once said, often God feels like saying, tell you what, it's your plan, you bless it. Because we haven't actually sought God to listen to him, to hear what he would have us do. So we need to learn from Jesus' example here. Jesus knows he is facing a momentous decision. Choosing these 12 disciples will have an incredible impact on the future of the church. He's got to get it right. He's got to pick the 12 who are the right choice for taking the church forward. And facing such a decision, he spends the whole night in prayer. So just that question, when did you last pray for an extended time? Now, I don't want everyone to go on a guilt trip. I don't want to go, oh, I'm so rubbish as a Christian. I only prayed for 3 hours today. It's not enough. But I do want us all to reflect on how easily we absorb the cultural norm of everything being done instantaneously. And how we need to challenge that and say, no, if we're really wanting to hear from God about big decisions in our lives, who we're going to marry, where we're going to work, where we're going to live, how we're going to take our lives forward in one or other area, then we need to be listening to God. And for that, we need to set aside time to pray, not just to talk, but to listen. Then the second thing we see here is that Jesus didn't choose everyone. Nowadays, of course, it's all like the opposite. When I was a child, they really weren't that bothered about feelings or insecurities. And so it's like, no, you're rubbish. You're not in the team. And that was it. And I had teachers tell me I was rubbish. And that was quite acceptable in those days. But then I'm so old, I actually got smacked in school. So that's how long ago it was that I was at school. I totally deserved it. It's hard to believe, and I was quite an annoying sort of pupil to have. Always got comments, always saying things, and always getting into trouble. I've matured a lot. So nowadays, of course, it's the idea of prizes for everyone. Everyone must be chosen. Jesus doesn't do that. He chooses just 12. And that's because it's not effective to try and disciple everyone. So Jesus was picking these 12 because he was going to work with them and equip them to continue his ministry after he'd gone. And that wasn't going to be effective if he tried to do crowds of people. That isn't going to work. If you ever tried to sort of, you know, communicate even on a one-to-one basis with a large number of people, it's very difficult to do. Jesus knows it's not possible to disciple everyone, not possible for him to disciple everyone. So he picks 12. And he focuses on discipling them, equipping them, so that they will take the work forward. And you see, what Jesus understood and what we need to understand, I really hope you get this from this morning, is that multiplication is the key. So often in churches, we tend to think of addition. We tend to think, oh, that's one extra person has joined this or done that, and that's good. But what we need to think is multiplication, because it is so much more effective than addition. I've got here, now some of you will know this, although I actually worked it out. I sat down and worked out the answer. And it was more shocking than I expected. So if I said to you, you had the choice this morning, our treasurer was feeling very generous, and you had the choice, you could walk away this morning with £5 million in cash, or you could have 1p that would double in value every day for a month. Now, most people know that actually the answer is the 1p, not the 5 million, even though it seems quite counterintuitive. You think, well, 5 million, that's a lot of money. 1p, that isn't very much money. Surely, yo, I could go with the 5 million. That would be good. I sat down and worked it out. And the answer, because I know you want to know this, the answer is if you started with 1p and you doubled it every day for a month, a 31-day month, you would end up with 10,737,418.24. Over double what you would have if you'd walked away with the 5 million. That is the power of multiplication. And Jesus realized, rather than just try and disciple everyone, he was going to disciple 12, who would then in turn disciple others, who would then in turn disciple others. And Jesus began with 12 disciples. Today around the world, it's estimated 2.2 billion people claim to be Christians. Now, that's varying levels of discipleship. Some of those we would sort of not exactly count as disciples. But 2.2 billion people today from those 12 who Jesus equipped and sent out. I hope you're getting the idea. Multiplication of us equipping others who equip others who equip others is an incredibly effective way of seeing God's work advance. And that's what Jesus is doing here. And as we'll see in a moment, that's what we need to be thinking about as well. We need to multiply churches as well as disciples. We need to be thinking that's why we're going to Faversham. That's why we'll then be going to Sittingbourne and elsewhere. We need to be expecting God to be at work multiplying. Multiplying disciples and then multiplying churches. And it's important that it's that way round, because what we're not wanting is just drawing a crowd. It's very easy to create crowds. You can just do all sorts of odd things. When I worked with open air campaigners, it was the first Christian thing I did. We used to do things. I don't know why I tended to get this job, where you would start off in a shopping centre somewhere and you had to do something bizarre to attract a crowd. And usually I got that job. And so you could either be, so I did like a one-man play where I was talking to myself. I did a one-man interview. I interviewed myself. That was really interesting. I caught myself out with some of the questions. So I had like two chairs and I would interview myself jumping from chair to chair. And people would stop, you see, like, what's going on? What is that guy doing? And then when you got a crowd, then someone else would come along and sort of cart me off and then sort of talk to people about what was happening. It's easy to draw a crowd. You just have to be a little bit odd or doing something unusual and you can draw a crowd. That is not a church. A crowd is not a church. A church is where people are growing as disciples of Jesus, where people are living their lives for his glory. And so we're not trying to create lots of crowds. We want disciples who will multiply, and then inevitably that will lead to churches multiplying, because there just won't be enough room to fit them all in. And so we need to be asking ourselves, are we seeking to multiply as we see Jesus multiplying through his disciples? Now, one of the things that you notice with these 12, Jesus spends the whole night praying. He then picks these 12. To be honest, he picks a really quite odd group. And I've got there, so there's hope for you and me. Because that might be you look at yourself and you think, you know what, I'm not really much of a disciple. If Jesus was picking 12 out of all of us here for disciples, he certainly wouldn't pick me. Well, that may be true. But when we look at the 12 that he did pick, they were odd. They all had massive failings. And yet he chose them deliberately. I'm not going to go through all 12, but I've picked out some of the sort of key characters. So firstly, we've got Simon Peter, who, if you've got any sort of Christian background, you'll be aware of Simon Peter. Simon Peter was quite an impulsive guy. We see that all the way through. He tended to speak before he thought. Absolutely nothing like me, for example. He was very impulsive, would put his foot in it. He'd say things, he'd commit to stuff he couldn't possibly keep to. Really impulsive, all over the place chap. Jesus chose him. And you've got James and John, the two power-hungry brothers, who prompted their mother to ask Jesus for them to have more glory in heaven. And said, oh, Lord, can we have thrones next to yours? Because we see ourselves as a bit better than the rest of the disciples, to be honest. And we want extra glory. We want more power. We want more recognition. Not exactly great qualities that you'd be looking for in disciples, but Jesus chose them. And then you've got Matthew, who was a tax collector, a cheat, and a traitor. A traitor to his own people, working for the Roman occupying force, would have been taking money. That's the way the tax collectors worked. They added a bit extra to your tax and then kept it for themselves. Really not a nice guy. And if you were thinking of who you might want in your gang, as it were, he wouldn't be high on the list. Then Simon the Zealot. The Zealots were a group who were around at the time of Jesus. And as their name suggests, they were very zealous. They were quite a violent group. Nowadays, we probably call them a terrorist group. They would assassinate Roman soldiers and sabotage Roman equipment, things like that. They really hated the Romans. They also really hated collaborators like Matthew. So in any other context, apart from being a disciple of Jesus, Simon would have been trying to kill Matthew. So you think some of our church meetings get a bit lively. You can't imagine sort of conversations they would have had around the fireplace. You know, Simon said, well, I really hate those scummy tax collectors who side with the Romans. And Matthew saying, well, these zealots go around killing people, just cause trouble for us. They must have had some fascinating conversations as they were growing in their faith and following Jesus. Then you've got Thomas, who wasn't sure any of it was true anyway. I always imagine Thomas maybe, in my mind, when I get to heaven, he'll probably be upset at this, assuming they listen to my sermons in heaven. But Thomas will be sort of, I imagine him a little bit vacant. So the one who didn't quite get it all the time. You know, those sort of people you're having a conversation and they just haven't quite got it. No, that wasn't what we meant. And I imagine Thomas a bit like that. When they say to him, we've seen the Lord, he's risen. Thomas is like, really? No, I don't think so. Hardly a man of faith setting the world on fire by his faith. He wasn't even sure it was true. And then, of course, Judas Iscariot, who one would have to say was not a great choice in the sense of he was stealing from the disciples, pocketing the money that they gave to him to give to the poor. He decided, hey, I'm poor. I may as well keep it. And then ultimately, of course, betraying Jesus and selling him out to the Romans. So when you look at that group, you think, that's an odd group Jesus has chosen. He spends the whole night praying and chooses this group. But what we see is that this is a consistent theme throughout the whole Bible. If you look at Hebrews chapter 11, the book of Hebrews is in the New Testament part of the Bible. And in chapter 11, they list what they call the heroes of the faith. That's all the people in the Old Testament who God used powerfully. And when you actually go through that list in Hebrews 11, they all got things massively wrong. There's no one on that list who's an outstanding example. They all got things wrong. They all had sinful qualities that at one level would have seemed to disqualify them from discipleship, but actually didn't, because God could work with them and through them. And that's so important. Because it'd be very easy for us, if we're looking at our lives honestly, it'd be very easy for us to look at our lives and say, you know what, I'm not really much of a Christian, I'm not really much of a disciple. I struggle with doubt, or I struggle with this or that. There's other things going on in my life. If people knew what I was really like, I don't think they'd even let me come to church. I've got stuff that's not good going on in my life. But God deliberately, through Jesus, chooses people who have these issues. Why does he do that? Because Jesus can use anyone who is willing, no matter who we are. All you need is to be willing to be used, and God can use you. And you see, the glory then goes to God, not to you, because it quite obviously isn't you and me, because of our inadequacies. It's quite obviously a work of God that has brought it about. And so it should encourage us. All God asks is that we be willing. And if we are willing, He will do the work through us to equip us, to enable us, and to make us who we want to be ultimately. I want to finish with two big questions. I really would encourage you not to just dismiss these questions. I'm really hoping that you'll be thinking about these through the week. I'm really hoping it'll be questions that almost bug you a bit. That you think, oh, I don't know, I need to wrestle with that some more. First one seems an obvious one. Are you living as a disciple of Jesus? Jesus isn't here today to choose a particular number. But if we are believing in him, if we're following him as Christians, then we should be seeking to live as a disciple of Jesus. Now, one of the problems is that often we're not really sure what that means. And one of the sort of weird benchmarks I have for myself, which is a slightly odd one, but it works for me, is how is my life different from that of my nice, middle-class, non-Christian neighbours? How is my life different from that of my very nice, middle-class, non-Christian neighbours? I live in Cherry Drive. It's a very nice road full of very nice people who, you know, would help out if you needed it and don't get stressed if you park across their drive. And you know, it's a very nice road, a very nice people. That's why we moved there, because we thought we're nice and they're nice, so we'll all get on and it'll all be nice. That is not discipleship. How is my life different? If the only difference is that I spend Sunday morning in a different place from them, or the only difference is that the money they pay to belong to an exclusive golf club I give to the church, how is that really any different? Is that really what Jesus means when he says, come and follow me? Does the Greek imply come and become nice and middle class and Western? There should be, I'm not talking about us all being weirdos and stuff like that. One of my favourite Christian posters is God wants spiritual fruit, not religious nuts. Yeah, I'm not talking about us becoming weird. But what is it about us? What is it in our lives that people see that they think, well, that is different? Where is the sacrifice in the way we live that marks us out as different from the normal middle class Canterbury that we find ourselves in? How are we really different? Is it just how we use Sunday morning and how we use a little bit of our money? Or is there a radically different focus to our lives? So although we live in the same sort of roads, it's very obvious to people that the driving force of our life is not our career or getting our children to a good school or obsessing over what happened to our car. But the radically different focus of our lives is that we're seeking to live for Jesus. That pleasing him is the centre of our lives, not all the things that the world values. And if we put him first, all those other things will fall into place anyway. But are we living as a disciple of Jesus? And secondly, are you seeking to help someone else as a disciple? You see, what I long for is for us to become a multiplying church. Not just in the sense of lots of babies in the creche. We're doing quite well on that one. That's going well and, you know, keep it up. But how are we discipling one another? Each of us should be able to say, yeah, actually, I'm spending time with so-and-so. And I'm encouraging them and they're encouraging me. We're discipling one another. I don't know how many of you are in growth groups, but that's a really key part of our church. And if you're not in a growth group, you really should be getting into one. And Oz will very happily help you organise that, if that's something that God convicts you of. But the dream would be that each of us are discipling someone else. And then a couple of years down the road, that person is discipling someone and we've gone on to someone else. And before we know it, we're starting to see a real change in people's lives. And a real impact across our city and our nation. So I want to finish with those two questions. Firstly, are you living as a disciple? Obviously, none of us get it right all the time. There's so much in my own life that is wrong, that I'm ashamed of, I'm struggling with. But is the desire there to live as a disciple of Jesus? And secondly, who are you discipling or who are you going to disciple? And let's get to the stage where that's not a weird question in our church. That you could go up to someone over coffee and say, I'd really like to be meeting up with you to be praying, looking at the Bible, challenging one another, encouraging one another in discipleship, and then not think, whoa, that's a bit weird. People would almost expect me and Oz to do that because, you know, we're sort of extra holy and extra spiritual. But I want to get to that point where it's just normal. Where all of us are just engaging with one another, encouraging one another, meeting up to disciple one another in that way. Now you're thinking, oh, I could never do that. I could never go up to someone and say, you know, would you like to join a growth group with me? Well, if you're very shy, you can't do that. Ask someone to do it on your behalf. You know, like when you were at school and you really fancied a girl, you couldn't ask her to go out with you. So you ask a friend to ask her, was it just me? No one else did that. So, you know, Oz is very happy to do that. And not for the relationships bit, but for the growth groups. But let's just think, what could we achieve as a church if we're discipling one another and really living in the way that Jesus called us to? We should all be seeking to do this. Imagine the impact on our world. Think of that multiplication thing. 1p after 31 days is £10,741,000. What would the sort of 200 to 300 people here become if we were multiplying one other disciple a year? What impact could that have going forward? So I want to finish with those two questions. Jesus chose those 12 disciples. He chose odd, inadequate, sinful people, because actually that's all God ever has to work with, because we're all like that. And so you qualify to be a disciple if you are odd, inadequate, or sinful. And I can guarantee one of those three will apply to you, for some of us, all three. Therefore, we qualify. So let's live as disciples of Jesus. Let's seek to disciple others as we go forward. Shall we pray? Lord Jesus, we thank you for your willingness to work with human beings who are so far away from what you would have us be. When we look at your example, Lord Jesus, and then we look at ourselves, we see such a gulf between us. But our desire is to be your disciple. Our desire is to live for you. Please help us going forward from today to take this seriously. To live so that those around us can see that the driving force of our lives is our faith in you and our desire to please you. In your name, amen.